The Tape Measure Murder. Miss Pollitt took hold of the knocker and rapped politely on the cottage door. After a discreet interval, she knocked again. The parcel under her left arm shifted a little as she did so, and she readjusted it. Inside the parcel was Mrs. Spenlow's new green winter dress, ready for fitting. From Miss Pollitt's left hand dangled a bag of black silk, containing a tape measure, a pincushion, and a large, practical pair of scissors. Miss Pollitt was tall and gaunt, with a sharp nose, pursed lips, and meagre iron-grey hair. She hesitated before using the knocker for the third time. Glancing down the street, she saw a figure rapidly approaching. Miss Hartnell, jolly, weather-beaten, 55, shouted out in her usual loud bass voice, "Good afternoon, Miss Pollitt." The dressmaker answered, "Good afternoon, Miss Hartnell." Her voice was excessively thin and genteel in its accents. She started life as a lady's maid. "Excuse me," she went on, "but do you happen to know if by any chance Mrs. Spenlow isn't at home?"
"Not the least idea," said Miss Hartnell.
"It's rather awkward, you see. I was to fit on Mrs. Spenlow's new dress this afternoon. 3:30, she said." Miss Hartnell consulted her wristwatch.
"It's a little past a half hour now."
"Yes, I've knocked three times, but there doesn't seem to be any answer, so I was wondering if perhaps Mrs. Spenlow might have gone out and forgotten. She doesn't forget appointments as a rule, and she wants the dress to wear the day after tomorrow." Miss Hartnell entered the gate and walked up the path to join Miss Pollitt outside the door of Laburnum Cottage.
"Well, why doesn't Gladys answer the door?" she demanded. "Oh, no, no, of course it's Thursday. Gladys stays out. Expect Mrs. Spenlow has fallen asleep. Well, I don't expect you've made enough noise with this thing." And seizing the knocker, she executed a deafening rat-a-tat-tat, and in addition thumped upon the panels of the door. She also called out in a stentorian voice, "What ho, within there!" There was no response. Miss Pollitt murmured, "Well, I think Mrs. Spenlow must have forgotten and gone out. I'll call round some other time," and she began edging away down the path. "Nonsense," said Miss Hartnell firmly. "She can't have gone out. I'd have met her. I'll just take a look through the windows, see if I can find any sign of life."
She laughed in her usual hearty manner to indicate that it was a joke, and applied a perfunctory glance to the nearest window pane. Perfunctory because she knew quite well that the front room was seldom used, Mr. and Mrs. Spenlow preferring the small back sitting room. Perfunctory as it was, though, it succeeded in its object. Miss Hartnell, it's true, saw no signs of life. On the contrary, she saw, through the window, Mrs. Spenlow lying on the hearth rug, dead.
"Of course," said Miss Hartnell, telling the story afterwards, "I managed to keep my head. That Pollitt creature wouldn't have had the least idea of what to do. Got to keep our heads," I said to her. "You stay here, and I'll go for Constable Polk." She said something about not wanting to be left, but I paid no attention at all. One has to be firm with that sort of person. "I've always found they enjoy making a fuss. So I was just going off when at that very moment Mr. Spenlow came round the corner of the house." Here Miss Hartnell made a significant pause. It enabled her audience to ask breathlessly, "Oh, tell me, how did he look?" Miss Hartnell would then go on, "Frankly, I suspected something at once. He's far too calm. Didn't seem surprised in the least. And you may say what you like, it isn't natural for a man to hear that his wife is dead and display no emotion whatever." Everybody agreed with this statement. The police agreed with it too. So suspicious did they consider Mr. Spenlow's detachment that they lost no time in ascertaining how that gentleman was situated as a result of his wife's death. When they discovered that Mrs. Spenlow had been the moneyed partner and that her money went to her husband under a will made soon after their marriage, they were more suspicious than ever. Miss Marple, that sweet-faced and some said vinegar-tongued elderly spinster who lived in the house next to the rectory, was interviewed very early, within half an hour of the discovery of the crime. She was approached by Police Constable Polk, importantly thumbing a notebook. "If you don't mind, ma'am, I've a few questions to ask you,"
Miss Marple said. "In connection with the murder of Mrs. Spenlow?" Polk was startled.
"I asked, madam, how you got to know of it."
"The fish," said Miss Marple. The reply was perfectly intelligible to Constable Polk. He assumed correctly that the fishmonger's boy had brought it, together with Miss Marple's evening meal. Miss Marple continued gently, lying on the floor in the sitting room strangled, possibly by a very narrow belt. But whatever it was taken away. Polk's face was wrathful. How that young Fred gets to know everything. Miss Marple cut him short adroitly. She said, "There's a pin in your tunic." Constable Polk looked down, startled. He said, "Well, they do say, see a pin, pick it up, and all the day you'll have good luck. I hope that'll come true. Now, what is it you want me to tell you?" Constable Polk cleared his throat, looked important, and consulted his notebook. "Statement was made to me by Mr. Arthur Spenlow, husband of the deceased. Mr. Spenlow says that at 2:30, as far as he can say, he was rung up by Miss Marple and asked if he would come over at 3:15. She was anxious to consult him about something. Now, ma'am, is that true?"
"Certainly not," said Miss Marple.
"You did not ring up Mr. Spenlow at 2:30?
"Neither at 2:30 nor any other time."
"Ah," said Constable Polk, and sucked his moustache with a good deal of satisfaction. "What else did Mr. Spenlow say?" "Mr. Spenlow's statement was he came over here as requested, leaving his own house at 3:10, and that on arrival here he was informed by the maidservant that Miss Marple was not at home."
"That part of it is true," said Miss Marple. "He did come here, but I was at a meeting in the Women's Institute."
"Ah," said Constable Polk again.
Miss Marple exclaimed, "Do tell me, Constable, now do you suspect Mr. Spenlow?"
"Not for me to say at this stage, but it looks to me as though somebody naming no names has been trying to be artful."
Miss Marple said thoughtfully, "Mr. Spenlow?" She liked Mr. Spenlow. He was a small, spare man, stiff and conventional in speech, the acme of respectability. It seemed odd that he should have come to live in the country. He had so clearly lived in towns all his life. To Miss Marple he confided the reason. He said, "I've always intended, ever since I was a small boy, to live in the country some day and have a garden of my own. I've always been very much attached to flowers. My wife, you know, kept a flower shop. That's where I saw her first." A dry statement, but it opened up a vista of romance. A younger, prettier Mrs. Spenlow, seen against a background of flowers. Mr. Spenlow, however, really knew nothing about flowers. He had no idea of seeds, of cuttings, of bedding out, of annuals or perennials. He had only a vision of a small cottage garden, thickly planted with sweet-smelling, brightly coloured blossoms. He had asked almost pathetically for instruction, and had noted down Miss Marple's replies to questions in a little book. He was a man of quiet method. It was perhaps because of this tray that the police were interested in him when his wife was found murdered. With patience and perseverance, they learnt a good deal about the late Mrs. Spenlow, and soon all St. Mary Mead knew it too. The late Mrs. Spenlow had begun life as a between-maid in a large house. She had left that position to marry the second gardener, and with him had started a flower shop in London. The shop had prospered. Not so the gardener, who before long had sickened and died. His widow carried on the shop and enlarged it in an ambitious way. She had continued to prosper. Then she'd sold the business at a handsome price and embarked upon matrimony for the second time with Mr. Spenlow, a middle-aged jeweller who had inherited a small and struggling business. Not long afterwards they'd sold the business and came down to St. Mary Mead. Mrs. Spenlow was a well-to-do woman. The profits from her florist establishment she had invested under spirit guidance, as she explained to all and sundry. The spirits had advised her with unexpected acumen. All her investments had prospered, some in quite a sensational fashion. Instead, however, of this increasing her belief in spiritualism, Mrs. Spenlow basely deserted mediums and sittings and made a brief but wholehearted plunge into an obscure religion with Indian affinities, which was based on various forms of deep breathing. When, however, she arrived at St. Mary Mead, she had relapsed into a period of Orthodox Church of England beliefs. She was a good deal at the vicarage and attended church services with assiduity. She patronised the village shops,
took an interest in the local happenings, and played village bridge. A humdrum, everyday life. And suddenly, murder. Colonel Melchip, the chief constable, had summoned Inspector Slack. Slack was a positive type of man. When he had made up his mind, he was sure. He was quite sure now. "Husband did it, sir," he said. "You think so?" "Quite sure of it. I'd got to look at him, guilty as hell. Never showed a sign of grief or emotion. Came back to the house knowing she was dead." "Wouldn't he at least have tried to act the part of the distracted husband?" "Not him, sir. Too pleased with himself. Some gentlemen can't act. Too stiff." "Any other woman in his life?" Colonel Melchett asked. "Haven't been able to find any trace of one. Of course, he's the artful kind. He'd cover his tracks. As I see it, he was just fed up with his wife. She got the money. As you say, she was a trying woman to live with, all taking up with some ism or other. He cold-bloodedly decided to do away with her and live comfortably on his own." "Yes, that could be the case, I suppose." "Depend upon it, that was it. Made his plans careful, pretended to get a phone call." Melchett interrupted him. "No call been traced?" "No, sir. That means either he lied, or that the call was put through from a public telephone booth. The only two public phones in the village are at the station and the post office." "Post office it certainly wasn't. Mrs. Blade sees everyone who comes in. Station it might be. Train arrives at 2:27, and there's a bit of a bustle then. But the main thing is, he says it was Miss Marple who called him up, and that certainly isn't true. Call didn't come from her house, and she herself was away at the Institute." "You're not overlooking the possibility that the husband was deliberately got out of the way by someone who wanted to murder Mrs. Spenlow?" "Oh, you're thinking of young Ted Gerard, aren't you, sir? I've been working on him. What we're up against there is lack of motive. He doesn't stand to gain anything. He's an undesirable character, though. Quite a pretty little spot of embezzlement, to his credit. I'm not saying he isn't a wrong un. Still, he did go to his boss and own up to that embezzlement, and his employers weren't wise to it." "An Oxford grouper," said Melchett. "Yes, sir. Became a convert and went off to do the straight thing and own up to having pinched money. I'm not saying, mind you, that it mayn't have been astuteness. May have thought he was suspected and decided to gamble on honest repentance." "You've a sceptical mind, Slack," said Colonel Melchett. "By the way, have you talked to Miss Marple at all?" "What's she got to do with it, sir?" "Oh, nothing. But she hears things, you know. Why don't you go and have a chat with her? She's a very sharp old lady." Slack changed the subject. "One thing I've been meaning to ask you, sir, that domestic service job where the deceased started her career, Sir Robert Abercrombie's place, that's where that jewel robbery was. Emeralds, worth a packet. Never got them. I've been looking it up. Must have happened when the Spenlow woman was there, though she'd have been quite a girl at the time. Don't think she was mixed up in it, do you, sir? Spenlow, you know, one of those little tuppenny halfpenny jewellers. Just the chap for a fence." Milchett shook his head. "Don't think there's anything in that. She didn't even know Spenlow at the time. I remember the case. Opinion in police circles was that a son of the house was mixed up in it. Jim Abercrombie, awful young waster, had a pile of debts, and just after the robbery they were all paid off. Some rich woman, so they said, but I don't know. Old Abercrombie hedged a bit about the case. Tried to call the police off." "It's just an idea, sir," said Slack. Miss Marple received Inspector Slack with gratification, especially when she heard that he'd been sent by Colonel Melchett. "Now, really, that's very kind of Colonel Melchett. I didn't know he remembered me." "He remembers you all right. Told me that what you didn't know of what goes on in St. Mary Mead isn't worth knowing." "Too kind of him, but really, I don't know anything at all about this murder, I mean. You know what the talk about it is?" "Oh, of course, but it wouldn't do, would it, to repeat just idle talk?" Slack said with an attempt at geniality, "This isn't an official conversation, you know. It's in confidence, so to speak." "You mean you really want to know what people are saying? Whether there's any truth in it or not?" "That's the idea." "Well, of course, there's been a great deal of talk and speculation, and there are really two distinct camps, if you understand me. To begin with, there are the people who think that the husband did it. A husband or a wife is, in a way, the natural person to suspect, don't you think so?
Maybe, said the inspector cautiously.
Such close quarters, you know. And then, so often, the money angle. I hear that it was Mrs. Spenlow who had the money, and therefore Mr. Spenlow does benefit by her death. In this wicked world, I'm afraid the most uncharitable assumptions are often justified.
He comes into a tidy sum, all right.
Just so. It would seem quite plausible, wouldn't it, for him to strangle her, leave the house by the back, come across the fields to my house, ask for me, and pretend he'd had a telephone call from me, and then go back and find his wife murdered in his absence, hoping, of course, that the crime would be put down to some tramp or burglar. The inspector nodded. What with the money angle, and if they'd been on bad terms lately. But Miss Marple interrupted him. Oh, but they hadn't. You know that for a fact? Everyone would have known if they'd quarrelled. The maid, Gladys Brent, she'd have soon spread it round the village. The inspector said feebly, she mightn't have known, and received a pitying smile in reply. Miss Marple went on, and there's the other school of thought, Ted Gerard, a good-looking young man. I'm afraid, you know, that good looks are inclined to influence one more than they should. Our last curate but one. Quite a magical effect. All the girls came to church, evening service as well as morning, and many older women became unusually active in parish work, and the slippers and scarves that were made for him. Quite embarrassing for the poor young man. But let me see, where was I? Oh, yes, this young man, Ted Gerard. Of course, there has been talk about him. He's come down to see her so often. Though Mrs. Spenlow told me herself that she was a member of what I think they call the Oxford Group, a religious movement. They are quite sincere and very earnest, I believe, and Mrs. Spenlow was impressed by it all. Miss Marple took a breath and went on. And I'm sure there was no reason to believe that there was anything more in it than that. But you know what people are, quite a lot of people, convinced that Mrs. Spenlow was infatuated with the young man, that she lent him quite a lot of money. And it's perfectly true that he was actually seen at the station that day, in the train, the 2:27 down train. But of course it would be quite easy, wouldn't it, to slip out of the other side of the train and go through the cutting and over the fence and round by the hedge and never come out of the station entrance at all. So she need not have been seen going to the cottage. And of course people do think that what Mrs. Spenlow was wearing was rather peculiar.
Peculiar?
A kimono, not a dress. Miss Marple blushed. That sort of thing, you know, is perhaps rather suggestive to some people.
You think it was suggestive?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think it was perfectly natural.
You think it was natural?
Under the circumstances, yes. Miss Marple's glance was cool and reflective. Inspector Slack said, might give us another motive for the husband, jealousy. Oh, no, Mrs. Spenlow would never be jealous. He's not that sort of man who notices things. If his wife had gone away and left a note on the pincushion, it'd be the first he'd know of anything of that kind. Inspector Slack was puzzled by the intent way she was looking at him. He had an idea that all her conversation was intended to hint at something that he didn't understand. She said now, with some emphasis, didn't you find any clues, Inspector? On the spot?
People don't leave fingerprints and cigarette ash nowadays, Miss Marple.
But this, I think, she suggested, was an old-fashioned crime. Slack said sharply, now what do you mean by that? Miss Marple remarked slowly, I think you know that Constable Polk could help you. He was the first person on the scene of the crime, as they say. Mr. Spenlow was sitting in a deck chair. He looked bewildered. He said in his thin, precise voice, I may, of course, be imagining what occurred. My hearing is not as good as it was, but I distinctly think I heard a small boy call after me, Yah, who's a crippin? It conveyed the impression to me that he was of the opinion that I had killed my dear wife. Miss Marple, gently snipping off a dead rose head, said, That was the impression he meant to convey, no doubt. But what could possibly have put such an idea into a child's head? Miss Marple coughed. Listening, no doubt, to the opinions of his elders. You really mean that other people think that also? Quite half the people in St. Mary Mead. But, my dear lady, what can possibly have given rise to such an idea? I was sincerely attached to my wife. She did not, alas, take to living in the country as much as I had hoped she would do, but perfect agreement on every subject is an impossible idea. I assure you I feel her loss very keenly. Probably, but if you will excuse my saying so, you don't sound as though you do. Mr. Spenlow drew his meagre frame up to its full height. My dear lady, many years ago I read of a certain Chinese philosopher who, when his dearly loved wife was taken from him, continued calmly to beat a gong in the street. A customary Chinese pastime, I presume, exactly as usual. The people of the city were much impressed by his fortitude. But, said Miss Marple, the people of St. Mary Mead react rather differently. Chinese philosophy does not appeal to them. But you understand, Miss Marple nodded. My Uncle Henry, she explained, was a man of unusual self-control. His motto was, never display emotion. He, too, was very fond of flowers. I was thinking, said Mr. Spenlow with something like eagerness, that I might perhaps have a pergola on the west side of the cottage, pink roses, and perhaps wisteria. And there is a white starry flower whose name for the moment escapes me. In the tone in which she spoke to her grand-nephew, aged 3, Miss Marple said, I have a very nice catalogue here with pictures. Perhaps you'd like to look through it. I have to go up to the village. Leaving Mr. Spenlow sitting happily in the garden with his catalogue, Miss Marple went up to her room, hastily rolled up a dress in a piece of brown paper, and leaving the house, walked briskly up to the post office. Miss Pollitt, the dressmaker, lived in the rooms over the post office. But Miss Marple did not at once go through the door and up the stairs. It was just 2:30, and a minute later the Much Benham bus drew up outside the post office door. It was one of the events of the day in St. Mary Mead. The postmistress hurried out with parcels connected with the shop side of her business, for the post office also dealt in sweets, cheap books, and children's toys. For some 4 minutes, Miss Marple was alone in the post office. Not till the postmistress returned to her post did Miss Marple go upstairs and explain to Miss Pollitt that she wanted her old grey crepe altered and made more fashionable, if that were possible. Miss Pollitt promised to see what she could do. The chief constable was rather astonished when Miss Marple's name was brought to him. She came in with many apologies. Oh, so sorry. So very sorry to disturb you. You are so busy, I know, but then you have always been so very kind, Colonel Melchett, and I felt I would rather come to you instead of Inspector Slack. For one thing, you know, I should hate Constable Polk to get into any trouble. Strictly speaking, I suppose he shouldn't have touched anything at all. Colonel Melchett was slightly bewildered. He said, Polk, that's the St. Mary Mead constable, isn't it? Well, what's he been doing? He picked up a pin, you know. It was in his tunic, and it occurred to me at the time that it was quite probable he'd actually picked it up in Mrs. Spenlow's house. Quite, but after all, no. Oh, what's a pin? Matter of fact, he did pick the pin up just by Mrs. Spenlow's body. Came and told Slack about it yesterday. You put him up to that, I gather. Oughtn't to have touched anything, of course, but as I said, well, what's a pin? Only a common pin, sort of thing any woman might use. Oh, no, Colonel Melchett, that's where you're wrong. To a man's eye, perhaps, it looked like an ordinary pin, but it wasn't. It was a special pin, a very thin pin, the kind you buy by the box, the kind used mostly by dressmakers. Melchett stared at her, a faint light of comprehension breaking in on him. Miss Marple nodded her head several times eagerly. Yes, yes, of course, it seems to me so obvious. She was in her kimono because she was going to try on her new dress, and she went into the front room, and Miss Pollitt said something about measurements, and put the tape measure round her neck. and then all she'd have to do was to cross it and pull.
Quite easy, so I've heard.
And then, of course, she'd go outside, pull the door to, and stand there knocking as though she'd just arrived. But the pin shows she'd already been in the house. And it was Miss Pollitt who telephoned to Spenlow.
Yes, from the post office at 2:30.
Just when the bus comes and the post office would be empty.
Colonel Melchett said, but my dear Miss Marple, why? In heaven's name, why? You can't have a murder without a motive.
Well, I think you know, Colonel Melchett, from all I've heard, that the crime dates from a long time back. It reminds me, you know, of my two cousins, Anthony and Gordon. Whatever Anthony did, always went right for him. And with poor Gordon, it was just the other way about. Race horses went lame, stocks went down, and property depreciated. As I see it, the two women were in it together.
In what?
The robbery. Long ago, very valuable emeralds, I've heard, the lady's maid and the tweeny, because one thing hasn't been explained. How, when the tweeny married the gardener, did they have enough money to set up a flower shop? The answer is, it was her share of the, well, the swag, I think is the right expression. Everything she did turned out well. Money made money, but the other one, the lady's maid, must have been unlucky. She came down to being just the village dressmaker. Then they met again, quite all right at first, I expect, until Mr. Ted Gerard came on the scene. Mrs. Spenlow, you see, was already suffering from conscience, and was inclined to be emotionally religious. This young man no doubt urged her to face up and to come clean, and I dare say she was strung up to do it. But Miss Pollitt didn't see it that way. All she saw was that she might go to prison for a robbery she had committed years ago. So she made up her mind to put a stop to it all. I'm afraid, you know, that she was always rather a wicked woman. I don't believe she'd have turned a hair if that nice, stupid Mr. Spenlow had been hanged. Colonel Melchett said slowly, "We can verify your theory up to a point. The identity of the Pollitt woman with the lady's maid are the Abercrombies, but," Miss Marple reassured him, "it'll be all quite easy. She's the kind of woman who will break down at once when she's taxed with the truth. And then you see, I've got her tape measure. I abstracted it yesterday when I was trying on. When she misses it and thinks the police have got it, well, she's quite an ignorant woman, and she'll think it will prove the case against her in some way." She smiled at him encouragingly. "You'll have no trouble, I can assure you." It was the tone in which his favourite aunt had once assured him that he could not fail to pass his entrance examination into Sandhurst. And he had passed.